going to turn the floor over to Nick Stolte to get started with opening remarks. So Nick, at any point, you are welcome to share your screen. I'll confirm when your slides are up. And again, you can begin the session today. And it looks like those slides are up. Go right ahead.
All right. Thanks, Jean. Hello, everybody. It's good to have these M2S2 webinars back up and running. Our theme for today is the life of a conceptual site model, going from concept to response complete. So we're going to have four different presentations on the subject of conceptual site models, each one of them looking at the conceptual site model from a little bit of a different perspective. James is going to start us off with an overview. So even if you've been around for a long time and you are an expert, I highly recommend that you watch James's presentation. It's going to have some good information. It's going to sort of build the foundation for the follow-on presentations. We're going to have a couple little breaks worked in here, and we're going to try to stick to this agenda as best we can to help anybody that might be calling in for just one of the sessions. But if we do run a little over, we'll skip the breaks to make sure that we're finishing within our two-hour time window. I'm going to give a talk about using the CSM to categorize risk areas, and then Amanda is going to give a talk about the CSM from the perspective of the acquisition process. And Jason Blair has a talk about the lessons learned and the cost of a bad CSM. And then after that, we'll wrap it up. So before we get started, I've got just like a little exercise where I'm going to roll through some photos, just kind of get us thinking and illustrate, you know, a point that I'd like to make to keep in mind as we go through these presentations over the next couple hours. So I'm going to show you some photos and think to yourself, does this bring to mind current conditions or future expectations? So it's not a guessing game, so don't try to guess what you think it is, but just kind of the first thing that comes to mind when you see some of these photos. So starting here, you know, current conditions or future expectations. This is in West Virginia. This is part of the Dolly Sides Maneuver Area. Beautiful, beautiful part of the country. If you've never been there, I hope you get a chance to go, especially in the spring or the fall. Current conditions or future expectations. Oh, and I should mention, use the Q&A if you want to play along to sort of put in what you're thinking as we go through these. Okay, yeah, thanks. Current conditions, future expectations. So that is a shot of the Pacific Ocean from the Waikoloa Maneuver Area on the Big Island of Hawaii, another beautiful FUDS location. Current or future on this one? That is a cornfield in the dead of winter in western Kentucky. That's part of Camp Breckenridge, or the former Camp Breckenridge. There's a range complex there. What about this one? Current or future? This is Boise, Idaho. It's a trail system, former Boise Barracks. If you could zoom in on that sign on the bottom left where it says caution, there's a note about old artillery shells, you know, as part of our educational effort. Current or future? I think got a couple more here. Current or future on this one? That one there, Wagashant's Point Target. It's a little peninsula in Upper Lake Michigan. Another beautiful area. The black in the sky is actually flies. That part wasn't beautiful, but those flies are around in the spring. You know, they're just coming out, and we all had to get some bug nets after that. But still, it was it's a nice area. And then another coastal view. Now, this is from a recent trip, current or future. So this one actually, we did a time critical removal action. This is on the island of Saipan out in the Pacific. We removed over 2,000 MEC items from just a 14-acre site for a time critical removal action. The point of this little exercise is that there's often a very fine line between where the site is when we start and where we want to go, where we want it to be at the end of a remedial action. So oftentimes with these projects, we're operating within the margins, very, very fine line. And that's where I think the conceptual site model can really play an important role. So when we're finding lots of MEC and we can locate it and dig it, that's the easy part. But when we're working within the margins where we don't know what's there and the risk is a little bit more ambiguous, that's when things become a challenge. And that's when we really need to rely on the tools and processes that have been developed. And that's what we're going to kind of cover for today. So thanks for playing along. We're going to go right into James's talk, and I'll stop sharing. Thank you.
Okay, let me just get this going. There we go. Can everybody see my screen?
We can, but there we go.
Perfect. There we go, yeah. Okie dokie. So we're going to start this session off with some basics. And as Nick said, I'm sure that a number of you are all going to be fairly or are going to be familiar with many of the concepts we talk about during this presentation, but hopefully there'll be one or two new things to bring into the conversation. I'll mention to start with, as you see here, there's this EM 200-1-12, which is the USACE EM for conceptual site models. That's currently under revision, and while we have to go through the wonderful adventure of it going through stuffing at HQ, that should be coming out hopefully sometime soon this year. I'll be optimistic. But that will have some new stuff in it. It's been reorganized a bit to make it a little bit clearer, add in some requirements on virtual profiles, which we'll talk about later, and also add some more examples of CSMs. So look forward to that coming soon to a bookstore near you. Okay, so the conceptual site model. The first step whenever we're planning a project is to ask, what do we know about the site? That's a basic question, and it's very, very important for us to understand that before we start a project. And the answer to that question is basically the conceptual site model. The conceptual site model, it shows our basic understanding of the site. As I'm sure many of you know, we often say it's a dynamic model, because as the project moves forward and as the various projects in the different phases move forward, the CSM is constantly being changed and it's being updated with what we know, or maybe things that we found that we had in the CSM that aren't right, we'll take them out. It also supports project planning and communication throughout the project, because again, as we're trying to describe to people what situation are we dealing with at the site and then what have we found, basically the CSM is how we do that. If we don't have a good preliminary CSM at the start of a project, we don't know what our data gaps and data needs are, and therefore we can't plan the project well. So you can see why the preliminary CSM is so critical, and we'll go over that a little bit more later as well. The CSM is also how we present the results of the project. Basically, how the CSM has changed, what data gaps have we filled, all of that is critical information and is essentially the result of any project that we do. So another reason, and this is one of the ways I think about the CSM, it's really the core of the project. It's the common element that runs through every single phase. We start pulling it together during the site inspection, and then at every phase, we update it, we add more to it, we find out more about the site, throughout every single project phase until closeout. And basically through each phase, what should be happening is that the detail and the accuracy of that CSM should be getting greater as we advance through the project. But it really is the core of the project. The way that we describe the CSM is using various, we call them profiles. These various profiles just summarize all of the various aspects of the conceptual site model. It's just a nice, easy way for us to try and break up the data that we have in the conceptual site model. And these, in general, these are the facility profile, which addresses the site history and boundaries and so on and so forth. The physical profile, which is the natural factors that may affect contaminant release, fate, transport, or accessibility. The release profile, which is one of the ones we often focus on a lot, which is the types of contaminants that we have at the site and where those contaminants might be. Then we have the land use and exposure profile that describes land uses and activities and various exposure scenarios for our risk assessment. And then the ecological and cultural resources profile, that's kind of self-explanatory. We're looking at cultural resources and natural resources that happen to be at the site. And then finally, the vertical profile. This is something that we've typically called the vertical CSM in the past, but it's really just one other element of the CSM. So it's just another profile. And now through the next few slides, I'm going to go into each of these in a little bit more detail. So we start with the facility profile. So this includes information such as the site location, the size of the site, who the various landowners are. It also includes the concise history of the site. What was the site used for? Where were contaminants stored? Where were they used? Where might they be found based on the use of the site? Now, also an important thing to note here is that the history of the site should be described before, during, and post DoD use to the present day. Obviously, all of those land uses are going to have impact on the conceptual site model. They might all have impact on where contaminants might be, where various receptors might be. So it's important for us to cover that whole history of the site. We also, in the facility profile, typically identify the munitions or hazardous substances that are known or suspected to be present. That's obviously linked to the history of the site. We know
So James, we may have temporarily
these various items were used there. It also, go on.
So James, we had a brief pause in your audio there. Just wanted to let you know, I'll keep an ear on it. If it happens again, we might swap you to the phone line.
If it happens again, I can switch to the phone. Can you still hear me okay now?
I can.
Okay. I guess I can't ask which bit you lost because no one heard. But anyway, so it also should contain a concise summary of relevant findings from previous work that's been done. So obviously the CSM presented in the RI should describe work that's been done during the site inspection and maybe any other work that's been done at the site, because all of that work, again, contributes to our overall knowledge of the site. The CSM physical profile. This is relatively self-explanatory. Topography, vegetation, what geology and hydrology do we have there? The topography is obviously very important if we're going to be doing various surveys at the site. It's why it's important to understand that. Maybe there's going to be areas that are going to be harder to get into than others. Same with the kind of vegetation you have. That's going to be an important planning element in terms of where we may need to do brush clearing. So all of that information is very important. Geology and hydrology, groundwater depth may give us an indication of how likely it is that our contaminants might reach groundwater. The bedrock depth can be very important if we're doing a MEC removal or an investigation at a site where we have shallow bedrock. It's really important for us to try and present that information in the conceptual site model, because obviously we don't expect any MEC to be present beyond the depth of the bedrock. At most sites I've encountered, that doesn't end up being a factor. But there are sites we have which have very shallow bedrock that can actually really help us in when we come to plan a remedial action. So that's another important part of the CSM. Climate is often discussed. That's more useful maybe for work planning. When might the good or bad times of the year be to do our work? So that's another part of the CSM that has impact on the work we do. Sensitive resources, we'll mention this here. We obviously mention it in the ecological and cultural resources profile as well. But it's a good idea to get an initial indication of where the sensitive habitats might be. And then last but not least, if there are any physical access limitations to the site. Some of that may be due to topography, some of it may be due to landowners, various other things that things that are just going to make it hard for us to get into various locations at the site. I'm sure you all understand, because many of you may have gone through this before. When we try and do a project, it's really important for us to understand where we can get and where we can't. I would say to the people on the line from the core, it's important for us to find that information out when we're putting together the CSM that we attach to our RFPs. It's good information to communicate what we know about that to the contractor rather than just leaving it all to be found out later. So that's another reason for us to include that kind of information in the physical profile as well. The release profile. That's where we describe where known or suspected areas of contamination are, the kinds of release that we might have had, so whether or not it's a target or a maneuver area or an OBOD area. That's useful information to include in the release profile. We also include our current understanding of the location and distribution of the contaminants that we have at a site. Obviously, this is current understanding. So in the site inspection, our understanding is going to be much more limited than the understanding we have in an RI versus the understanding we might present in an RD. And then finally, obviously, as we get to the RA, hopefully our understanding is pretty well defined at that stage. But this is going to include both the horizontal and the vertical extent. The depth component is very important. We'll touch on the vertical profile again a little bit later. Also the infected environmental media. So is our contamination just in soil? Is it in sediment? Is there potential for MC to have got into surface water at the site or groundwater? It's important for all of those things to be reflected in the release profile. If we know anomaly densities, sometimes after the RI, we have an idea of that. That's another important part of the release profile, because those anomaly densities can be indicative of areas where we may have more contamination. And then finally, this is sometimes hard to find out, but if there's been any prior land disturbing activities or other processes that may have redistributed MEC around the site, such as maybe there was an area used for fill that where a bunch of soil was dug up and moved somewhere else. It's important if we can find that out, to find that out and put it in the release profile. Land use and exposure profile. This includes our current and reasonably anticipated future site uses. This includes land ownership and any zoning that we know about. We can
James.
Also talk about marine land uses, future receptors at the site.
James, I apologize. Yeah, if we could swap to the phone just to be on the safe side, that'd be great.
Nope. Okay.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Sounds like there was a sound delay on it as well, because I just caught the end of me speaking on my phone, which was very, very strange. Anyway, okay, I'm going to start this slide from the beginning. I don't know where I cut out. So the land use and exposure profile, that addresses current and reasonably anticipated future site uses, including ownership and zoning, also neighboring land uses, current and reasonably anticipated future receptors associated with those land uses. Bear in mind that for some land uses, there may be more than one receptor associated with that land use. And this, very, very importantly, and for for those of you who've heard any of my recent training or presentations, you'll be bored with hearing me say this, but it also includes the related activities and frequencies of what those receptors are doing on the site. We have been typically bad in the past at describing that information in conceptual site models. And we really need as much as we can to find that information out, because it has a huge impact when we come to do our risk assessments, and also when we come to try and implement remedies or to evaluate remedies during the FS and then put those remedies into practice. We really need to know what people are doing in order to know how best to protect them while they're doing it. Again, it talks about it needs to talk about access and land use restrictions, because again, those land use restrictions can have an impact on the land use and what those receptors might be doing. And finally, and probably most commonly, because most of you will have seen this little block flow diagram that's down in the bottom corner of the slide, it talks about the potentially complete exposure pathways. We'll talk a little bit more about exposure pathways later. We get to the ecological and cultural resources profile. This is going to be where we talk about the ecological and cultural uses of the area, just degree of disturbance. Also, any ecological receptors we have and the various habitat types that they might be found in. Specifically, things such as endangered or threatened species, migratory animals that may have habitat in the area and they may move through the area, so we need to be aware of that, and any other species that might be present. Also, any sensitive environments we have, such as wetlands, some. I'm trying to think of the word for the ponds, but anyway, any sensitive environments we have, how big they are, where they are, what kind of quality they are. Also cultural resource areas. Now, one important thing to remember here is that we typically do not put maps of cultural resource areas in any of our reports, because that information is generally close hold. But in terms of just the general details in the area, that obviously needs to be included in the conceptual site model in order that we can plan for that. If we come to do any work in the area, we need to make sure that we're basically being aware of all of the sensitive environments and cultural resources that may be there. This is why it's important to include this information in the conceptual site model. And also the relationship of any of the releases we have to the ecological or cultural resource areas that we've shown. And last, but definitely not least, the vertical profile. This is something that we've been talking about for a long time, but up until recently, we haven't really been explaining that well what kind of components need to go in it. But in general, the vertical profile is going to be talking about the contaminant depths we have, obviously when we're talking about MEC, the various depths at which we think we might find MEC. Also, when we're doing our investigations and when we're presenting the vertical profile at the conclusion of an investigation, we want to be showing things such as seed depths. Where are we going to be putting the seeds? How deep are we going to be putting them? Or how deep did we put them and where did we detect them down to? We also, on the vertical profile, we can display our instrument detection depths, both reliable detection depth and maximum detection depth. And also, coming back to land use again, what the land use depths are associated with the various activities that are at the site. And then when we get to an FS or a remedial action, we want to be showing the RAO depths or the removal depths that we're talking about in the FS and the remedial action. And I'll just put a plug in here. I don't think that we often think about doing this, but I would like to start seeing vertical profiles included in the FS. We typically have them in the RI, and then when we get to the FS, we don't really think about it anymore. But when you think about what you're doing in the FS with presenting remedial alternatives that are addressing or potentially addressing MEC and various land uses down to specific depths, including the vertical profile in that document and incorporating it into your evaluation is actually very important. So I'll make a plug for us all to start doing that from now on. So where do we get the data from? Other than the investigation we do, normally the starting point for our preliminary CSM is a preliminary assessment or a site inspection or the other reports that have been done prior to our work. These are a good starting point, but it's really important for us to bear in mind that they should not be the only sources we use. Sometimes these preliminary assessments are 10 or 15 years old. So we're essentially taking old, if all we do is use the preliminary assessment, all we're doing is taking 15-year-old data and putting today's date on it. So we really need to make sure that we verify to the greatest extent we can that that data is still current. In some cases, maybe it's the geology. It's probably likely that it's still current. But in other cases, in terms of things such as land use, there's a good chance that in 15 years, the land uses have changed somewhat. So it, again, it's important to verify that data and not just essentially upgrade or make it seem like that 15-year-old data is now current data. Other additional sources. So you can, and there's various record searches you can do. There are a number of online databases in various states that deal with and also federal databases that provide information on a lot of the things that we've talked about here. Some of that information actually will be, or some of those databases and some examples of those will be included in the new EM, the new conceptual site model EM when it comes out. We can also use personnel and property owner interviews, interviews with local safety officials. If we're working on a military installation, we can often talk to the base historian and the real property and range managers. Also, if we have any historical ground or, and aerial photos that we can get, they can be very informative about where various land uses may have taken in the past. And also, quite importantly sometimes, what features were present before the land was used as a range, or maybe the things that were present there when it was being used as a range. If you're concerned about whether or not MEC may be present underneath the building foundation, well, if you find out that the house has been there throughout the active or been in the area throughout the active life of the range, it's unlikely that there's going to be any ordnance present under it. So you can use those photographs to help you make conclusions and update your CSM that way. We also have a common operations, range operations, and installation reports. Those are available from the government. So for the various government PDT members, those are available. I think via the FUDS portal. If you can't find them, then you can contact the CX, and we can do our best to get you what you need. For contractors, you may need to try and get access to those through your government contacts. Also, of course, site visits. We have various site visits throughout the life of the project. That's another good chance to gather extra data. And last, but certainly not least, use the SPP meetings. We often forget about this. Generally, during SPP meetings, you have a bunch of stakeholders sitting there around the table, and that's a perfect opportunity to ask them questions about the site, and maybe you'll find out in information that you weren't aware of prior to that. So use those SPP meetings, make a point of thinking about the information you need to find out, and then bring it up and talk about it during the SPP meeting. So going on to exposure pathways, the CSM does identify the various exposure pathways at the site. Exposure pathways have four components. They have a source or release of contamination, an environmental transport mechanism and or exposure medium, an exposure point at which the receptor can come into contact with the contamination, and a receptor and a likely route of exposure at the exposure point. That's a whole bunch of words, I'm sorry, but it's really just a chain. You can see a little bit of an example of some exposure pathways here in this figure. And then on this slide, here's an example for MEC and an example for MC. So we have a source or release of contamination where we've done range training. That's resulted in MEC being present at the former target area. The exposure medium is the soil at the former target area. The exposure point is that we've got a recreational hiking trail passing through that area. And then the receptor and the likely route of exposure is that a hiker might encounter an item and then pick it up because they don't know any better. So there's your possible exposure pathway for MEC. For MC, it's kind of similar. One of the big differences with MC is that chemical contamination is generally more mobile or can be more mobile. So you can actually, in the second box here, you see that you could have munitions constituents in soil, but then they migrate to groundwater. So they start out in the soil in the soil medium, but then the exposure medium they end up in is actually groundwater, or at least I guess then they're in two different exposure media. And then in this case, the contaminated groundwater is used by drinking water, so then somebody drinks the water. So you can see how that exposure pathway works. You can also think of exposure pathways in a CSM as layers. So we would start with, say, our base map, and then you'd look at where the MEC or MC contamination is. Then you'd look at where your exposure media are, and then you could look at what your land uses are and where your receptors are at the site. And then you can look at where those different layers interact, and that will essentially show you some of the potential exposure pathways. This can also be presented quite well in a GIS. So here's the figure that you've probably seen many, many times in many, many reports. And often people refer to this as the CSM. Well, that's not actually true. This is just one way of displaying the CSM. But I'm sure many of you have seen this in many, many reports. One of the other things that the exposure pathways can do is show us which media need to be sampled. So for example, in this example here, we see that we have various potentially complete pathways. We have potentially complete pathways in surface water and sediments, potentially complete pathways for ecological receptors. We have potentially complete pathways in surface soil, none currently identified in subsurface soil. We're defining that as being anything deeper than 2 feet. And then we have some potentially complete exposure pathways in groundwater. And then we also have MEC exposure pathways in surface and subsurface soil. So looking at that, we now know these are the pathways that we need to sample. We need to basically evaluate these pathways in order that we can find out whether any of them have confirmed contamination, which could come into contact with our receptors. So that's yet another use of the conceptual site model. As I said earlier, CSM is good for identifying data gaps, because when we identify what we know about a site, this helps us to clarify what we don't know about the site. And then when we start looking at the potential exposure pathways we have and where those potential exposure pathways are complete, that then identifies to us what we need to know, which are our data needs. And the data needs, hopefully most of you know, that's what we identify in step 3 of the data quality objective process. So you can see how critical the CSM is towards driving the DQOs and how we perform our investigation. There are multiple ways of depicting the conceptual site model. You've already seen a few of them. The CSM, as we've just seen, contains an awful lot of information. It varies in content and level of detail. The more complex a site is, the more complex the conceptual site model is. And there's multiple ways to present this. We can have a simple figure or a narrative that may be sufficient for a simple site, but most sites are more complex than that. So we tend to need a written narrative coupled with tables, maps, and diagrams and other graphics. When we think about what's the best way to communicate the CSM to people, all of them. Basically, the more ways that we can find to present that data, the better our communication of the CSM is going to be. I'm just going to go through a few examples and give you some pros and cons of them now. So the narrative text description, pretty much every CSM has one of these. It's going to be a written description of site conditions based on the various profiles that we talked about earlier. It's going to summarize all of the information on contaminants, receptors, activities, and exposure routes. The advantages of the narrative description is that it can describe everything. Disadvantage is that it doesn't really have a spatial element where you can see where things are in relation to each other. And in general, it's because it's all text, because it's basically pages and pages of text, it's not as easy to follow as some of the other methods we use. We also have a table. Again, many of you have probably used a table like this or have seen a table like this. This typically shows the various conceptual site model elements or the main conceptual site model elements in various columns. So we have contaminants, receptors and activities, exposure routes. The advantages of this is that it really concentrates all of the key important details in one place, so it's a lot easier to follow. The disadvantages are, it's obviously not as detailed as all of the text. So we can't necessarily include all of the details we want in this table without making it just completely unwieldy. It also, again, it has no spatial element. We can describe where things are, but we can't really see where things are. We get to the pictorial CSM. Location, this really shows us the locations of contaminants, receptor activities, and exposure routes. The advantage of this is that it's very easy to understand. It prevents our spatial data. It shows where things are. And it's very useful for presenting the CSM to stakeholders. The disadvantages is that the details are somewhat limited, and some pictorial CSMs can be overly simplistic. You can see on this one, actually, we've got a couple of vertical profiles that are also shown on the figure. So this is a really good way of communicating this information to stakeholders. Plus, it looks really cool. Then we talked about the exposure pathway diagram. This summarizes our contaminants, release mechanisms, exposure media, receptors, complete and incomplete pathways. This, again, is a very, very useful tool for us to use. The advantage, it clearly shows us the complete and incomplete exposure pathways. Also, as we find that maybe there are additional exposure pathways, you can display those as well. You'll see on this particular example, there are actually little notes on this CSM explaining why some of the pathways are incomplete, showing the reasons that they are incomplete, and clarifying, for example, down at the bottom there, I realize the text might be quite small, but the groundwater is only used by nearby residential receptors. So that's why those pathways are only shown as being potentially complete for the residential receptors in the CSM rather than the other three receptor types that are listed. I think this is a good way, actually, by putting the notes on these flow diagrams, it's a good way to help communicate even more in information using these flow diagrams. The disadvantages, though, while they really focus in on the complete and incomplete exposure pathways, they're not as detailed in other ways. They don't always show you the types of contamination you have. And again, common complaint, there's no spatial element in here. The vertical profile, this, as we covered a little bit earlier, this will show your estimated MEC depths, the distribution, the maximum depth, seed depth intervals, MEC and seed detection depths, vertical distribution of items that you found, can show land use in interaction zone depths, the bedrock depth, if you know it, and the remedial action removal depths. The advantages of this, it can just show, I mean, it really does show all of the vertical data that you need for the site. This can help with you when you're developing remedial action objectives. It can help, as I mentioned earlier, in the FS, when you're looking at various remedial alternatives and comparing them with each other to say, well, which ones are addressing what, how well are they, can they detect the various MEC that you have at the site. The disadvantage, which is kind of obvious, it only shows vertical data, but it does show all of the vertical data. Then we have other methods. Really, any other map that we have in our report is part of the conceptual site model. We have loads of maps. I'm sure many of you have developed many, many of these maps in your time. This one, for example, this is a map showing the results of a DGM investigation. And then we have a related map that shows the anomaly density based on that DGM investigation. Then we have our intrusive results. And then finally, we have a look and we see where our HUAs are based on all of that. So you, again, all of these kind of maps, these help to bulk up the CSM and show all of the other data. And the last bullet there, whatever else you can come up with, I'm sure there are people out there who have other methods of describing the CSM that I haven't shown in this list. Any way that we can communicate the data more clearly, that's a valid way to depict the conceptual site model. I'm not sure if I'm ending way early or feels like that went really quickly. But anyway, so closing thoughts. The conceptual site model, it describes what we currently know about the site. Also, and very importantly for the various investigations we do, it identifies the data gaps that we need to fill. So that's an important thing to remember, an important thing to maybe include in your conceptual site model is a list of the current data gaps. The CSM is dynamic. It requires continual refinement. At the very least, we're going to have a preliminary CSM at the beginning of a project and a revised CSM at the end. But as you do data usability assessments and things like that, you'll often be going back. And one of the first questions you're going to ask is the conceptual site model still valid? Because if the conceptual site model has changed, that may have an impact on your data usability assessment. And it may, because it may have impacted your data quality objectives based on your CSM. All of these things are related together. CSM data can and should be displayed in multiple different ways. I reviewed the various ways or whole number of ways it can be presented, and really presenting it in all of those ways is the best way to communicate all of the data that you have. And the CSM is also critical in supporting both data quality objectives and remedial action objective development. And really, as I said earlier, the CSM is the core of the project. I mean, that's why it's so important. It really is just, it is the core of the project. Did any questions come in while I was talking and having sound problems?
Yes, James, we did have some questions. Great presentation. I think you really, really covered it well from an overview and made some really good points. One of the questions was, how frequently do you update a CSM?
I'm going to give a really vague answer. I mean, I'll give my standard MET response answer, which is it depends. But then I'll be a bit more I'll clarify a bit more. Well, as I think I said, at minimum, it should be updated at the end of a project phase. But really, you should be constantly updating the CSM throughout the project. Now, does that mean you need to reissue the Worksheet 10 conceptual site model? No, but you constantly, as you do data usability assessments and as you're out in the field collecting data, you should be constantly asking yourself, have we found anything that changes the CSM? Because the minute you find something that changes the CSM, you need to update the CSM in some way, because you may then need to adjust your technical approach or the approach to the project because your initial assumptions may have changed. I hope that answered the question. If not, feel free to ask again and I'll try and give a clearer answer.
That's the answer I was hoping that you would give. Another question is, how do you share a CSM and subsequent data with all the stakeholders so that everyone accesses the current one and uses all relevant historical data?
I would say there are multiple, I mean, obviously one way to do that is through the project documents. You could, if you decided that you wanted to put CSM data, you could probably put it on a website if you felt that was a valid way to keep stakeholders continually informed. You could, I mean, I don't think there's a specific formal way to do it. I think it would be like anything else. I mean, it may be worthwhile, for example, attaching the updated CSM to your data usability assessments throughout a project, and you should be communicating those to the various members of the project team, including some stakeholders. So I think that would be another way to do it, attach an updated CSM to the data usability assessment. So you'd be issuing that maybe two or three times during the course of a project. But really, it's going to depend on your project and what the needs are of those particular stakeholders.
Okay, well, along those lines, when are the tribes contacted during the CSM process?
I assume as stakeholders or as potential stakeholders, they should be contacted at the beginning of any project. I mean, I think that's maybe less a CSM issue than a project schedule, project management, project outreach issue. But I would assume the correct way to do that would be at the very beginning of the project.
Such as during the SPP meeting?
Yes. If you have tribes who are stakeholders, yes. Absolutely during the SPP. Yeah.
Okay. And there was a little bit of conversation about SPP. You know, a few years we went from the vernacular of TPP to SPP. And I just wanted you to clarify that for everybody, just so we're all on the same page to define SPP.
So SPP is systematic project planning. It was the term, I think, first came along with the development of the UFP QAP, though maybe I'm maybe wrong about that. And the core used to refer to technical project planning. We've since transitioned, since we've been using the QAP and that process, we started using SPP for systematic planning process rather than technical project planning. So you'll see most of our documents now refer to SPP rather than TPP. If you see TPP, it's probably in an older report. I don't know.
Excellent.
You may have something to add to that, Nick.
No, you covered it well. And then finally, I saved a tough one for the last. How does Section 106 or Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act inform the CSM?
Well, I'm not a natural resources person, but I would say you have to look at the ecological resources you have at the site. You have to make sure that you're complying with the various laws and so forth that relate to those to threatened and endangered species. I mean, this is one of the reasons that that's a profile in the CSM, is because before we actually get out to the site and start to tramp around and dig holes and do brush clearing, we need to know what we're going to be dealing with. So I would say that your CSM is going to inform your environmental protection plan, and that's how you'll be complying with those various things.
Okay. And we had one
that answers
come in.
The question.
Yeah, I think so. We had one come in sort of late, and I think it's going to be covered, but I'll go ahead and give you a shot at it too. How does the CSM effectively identify data gaps? It seems the CSM includes what is currently known about the site, but how does it specifically identify those data gaps?
It helps you to identify the data gaps because when you look at what your data needs are, when you're going through the data quality objective process, and you get to step three of that, and you say these are the data that we think we need to inform our project, you can essentially look at that list of data, compare it with the CSM, and see what you don't have. I mean, that probably makes it sound a little bit easier than it might be. But I mean, really, yeah, you just take that list of data needs, and if you put it side by side in a table with what you know from the CSM, you should see where all of the holes are. And those are going to be your data gaps.
Okay, very good. And I'm going to cover a little bit of that in my presentation too. So hopefully that question will be answered thoroughly before we're done here today. So with that, we're going to take a short break. Just keep everybody fresh. I know these webinars can be tough sometimes, and we all spend a lot of time in front of a computer screen. So we're going to come back and get started on the next one at 2:00 sharp. So take a few minutes, do what you need to do, stretch out, and be back at 2:00. Thanks. Thank you.
Welcome to the online meeting. We will get started shortly.
Okay, I believe we've reached the end of our scheduled break time. So I wanted to check to make sure that Nick Stolte is back with us on the line.
I am.
Okay. I see your screen, so go ahead, Nick.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about the conceptual site model in the context of the risk assessment. And starting with the end in mind, I'm going to go through here and, you know, interject some of my overall philosophies about the conceptual site model, as I think it's really the thing that, you know, sort of ties everything that we do together. And that is certainly true with regards to the risk assessment. This won't be a talk on the RMM or risk management methodology. But there is significant overlap, as there should be, because a well-developed CSM is certainly a critical component to having the ability to do a risk assessment. So I'm going to talk about the purpose of a CSM for munitions response. I'm going to review those CSM profiles that James just covered in a little less detail because I think they are important. We'll talk about the defining the assessment areas, identify receptor activities, and defining the interaction zones. So those last three bullets, if you have had the opportunity to review what is the draft of the update to the risk management methodology, those will look familiar to you. And we're going to talk about those, but again, from the perspective of a conceptual site model and what our data needs are. So conceptual models, we deal with models every day in our lives. Models are used for a variety of things. Oftentimes, they're just a scale representation of something else, like a kid building a model volcano or a model train. We've got scientific models that we use. Some are computer generated that might predict the effects of climate change.
Sometimes we have scientific physical models, such as down in Vicksburg. I'm not sure if that's still used today, but to model flooding of the Mississippi River Delta, and various other types of models in our world. But what we're going to focus on is the CSM, which is a scientific model that reflects the current understanding of a site, supports essential planning and communication of critical site information, provides input that supports identification of data quality objectives, or DQOs, and provides the basis of a risk assessment. So I got two pictures there. One we looked at before, that's the Waikoloa Maneuver Area. And then one is, I think, a lot of times how we view the one on the left, how we think about a munitions response site is some guy digging and hitting a bomb with his shovel. And both of those are components. You know, I kind of think of the digging, that's sort of the micro view of the CSM. And then the overall, you know, beautiful field with the ocean in the background as the macro view. And both of those are important. And we need to take the time to zoom in and zoom out, if you will, to really keep the big picture in context. So what do we need to know? Well, for the CSM, we need to know specifically about those profiles that James mentioned. And those are the facility profile, physical profile, release profile, land use and exposure profile, ecological and cultural resources profile. And additionally, we need to get data, anomaly density data, and we need to gather, make sure we're gathering enough data for remedial alternative development and cost estimating data. So those last three are very important, and there's been a number of presentations given on the subject. They won't be covered in further detail in this talk, but I did think it was worth mentioning here. And again, our engineering manual, which is currently being updated, 200-1-12, is your go-to for the conceptual site model. So here's an example. As I was putting this presentation together, I was kind of reflecting back, looking for some old slides that I could reuse and whatnot. And way back from 2010, I was on a detail, I was an intern on a detail with the EMCX, and I was helping to put together some of the original FUDS training. And, you know, I put together this slide for a CSM for a class activity. You know, I barely knew what a CSM was at the time. I had only recently learned the definition of munitions response site. But looking back on it, this thing really had all the components. You know, it's got the facility profile there and the FUDS property boundary or the MRA MRS boundary. It's got components of the land use and exposure profile with the development and the hiking trails. Of course, it's got components of the suspected the release profile, which is the impact area and the suspected firing point. And then the physical profiles there, which is the land, sea, and air. It's all there. And so it got me thinking, you know, we've always been doing this. A lot of this is sort of just inherent to the work we do, but we don't always recognize it for what it is. And I think one of the useful things that we've learned recently over the past few years is to categorize things and use the conceptual site model and put things in a familiar context. That gives us a little bit more consistency in our work and provides for an effective means of communication. So here's a recent example of a CSM, not too much different than the one I just showed you. It's a 3D, still a drawing. Yeah, I'm one that prefers the drawings, but there is utility certainly to the wire diagrams. One of the things that we've updated, and James talked about this, is the depth distribution profile, that vertical component, looking at things in three dimensions is especially important. You'll see in some of the updated guidance,
we talk about volumes of soil. So, you know, we're not just looking at things, you know, on flat ground from the aerial, but also looking in terms of depth. So what I've realized, and hopefully you do too, is that all CSMs do have the same essential building blocks. They have some commonalities. The facility profile, you know, in its most simple terms, in the munitions response world, is the MRS boundary. And that's going to be predefined. We have a MRS boundary, you know, as soon as we have a project. The physical profile, also predefined. You know, that's the land, air, and water. The release profile, known or potential categories of high use area, low use area, no evidence of use area. So we can more or less categorize that release profile. And we know or suspect that they exist, however the boundaries are unknown. And then the land use and exposure profile, somewhat predefined, but we do need to gather data for the specifics. So this is kind of getting back to one of the questions that came in earlier, how does CSM help you identify data needs? Here's an example. So I know that yellow blob exists somewhere on an MRS. I know that there's a high use area because I know there was a range and there was a target area. What I don't know is where it is. I don't know its location. I don't know its boundaries. And I don't know a lot of things about it, you know, including the depth, the distribution, anomaly density, and so on. So I'll design a study to try to fill those data gaps, identify those needs. Similarly, the land use and exposure profile. You know, I might know that there's some farmland and there's some developed areas and there's some trails, but I don't know specific activities that occur within those areas, or I don't know if there are plans for future development or construction that might impact my understanding of the conceptual site model. So that's how a conceptual site model really helps inform your investigation, helps inform your data gaps and your data needs. We all have these built essential building blocks. Every conceptual site model will have these. You know, the values will vary, of course. The shape will vary, but it's all kind of essentially the same. So knowing where we're going, you know, starting with the end in mind, the end can be the end of a phase or the big picture end, you know, after you've conducted a remedial action. You need to consider all those things. But the one in particular that I want to focus on is the end point of having a fully characterized site and being able to conduct a risk assessment. So, you know, we have to understand, you know, what our risk model is. And you see the risk model on the left. There's a presence of a MEC item. There's something that happens that causes a person to encounter it, and then there's some activity where there's an interaction, and then risk of an explosive incident. And then that model, of course, depends on the combination of the likelihood of all those things happening, the likelihood of the presence, and then feeds the likelihood of an encounter and an interaction, and then the risk, and so on. So again, without getting too far down the road of conducting the risk assessment, we just need to understand sort of the basic concept or the basic model. So when you look at the risk management methodology, you're going to see that it's broken down into five steps. Step one, review and consensus on the CSM. Talking a lot about that. Step two, define assessment areas. I'm going to cover that. Identify receptor activities, cover that as well, and also cover step four, define the interaction zone. Step five, I will not cover, you know, that's the last part, and that is to actually do the risk assessment. So you see that when I say significant overlap, I mean overlap with CSM. The CSM is really the first four steps of the RMM. And that's important, and that's important for us to realize and keep in mind. That it is our guide, that, you know, it feeds our remedial investigation, it feeds our remedial action. It really is the thing that ties it all together. How it supports, I'm not gonna read this to you. This is, I would rather just show you how it supports it. So we'll go through each of these steps and I'll show you. Starting with review and consensus on the CSM. So I'm gonna use an example. This is kind of an old example. Some of you might have seen a version of this before, but we're gonna start with an artillery range. Okay, so right off the bat, I've just got an aerial photo. So I've got a lot of information for the physical profile. You know, I know this area is forested. I can see a little road there. I can see some development. Then from my preliminary assessment, I probably got some historical data. That was supposed to be a little video, but anyway, I've got historical data about them, you know, firing, how this site was used. I've even got information about the munitions that were used. And this is all really pretty typical in our program that we'll have a basic understanding. You know, we've got a reason for saying an area is a munitions response site. So that's the example that we're following here. So we've got the basics of a conceptual site model. And then that will roll right into our facility profile, which, as I mentioned, in its most simple form, is simply the MRS boundary. That includes the site history, the site boundaries, man-made features, potential contamination sources. So we've got the facility profile there. As I mentioned, we've got the physical profile. That's the land, air, and water. But we also want to pay particular attention to natural factors that may affect release, bait, and transport or accessibility. Those factors might be erosion or frost heave, climate change is something that we're starting to look at as well. So I don't want, as I'm going through these, I don't want you to think that I'm oversimplifying it, these profiles. But I'm just trying to kind of lay the groundwork for it. Then the release profile, as I mentioned, in munitions response, the release profile is more or less where we're expecting to find munitions. So in this case, we know that they are firing from a certain point, hitting some sort of target. And then if we understand, you know, the mechanisms of munitions, we know that there's an explosion with fragmentary effects that diminish with distance. We know if they're firing continuously or consistently at a target, that there's going to be a high anomaly density area or an area out there that has, you know, a lot of metal in the ground. And of course, we've got geophysical sensors that can find that. And then if it's munitions related, we call it a high use area. And so it really can be boiled down. If you look at the MRQAP, that's where these terms come from, high use area and low use area. And then we've got no evidence of use area, which in this example is simply the area outside the MRS. It doesn't meet the definition of being a munitions response site. So our release profile is categorically high use area and low use area. Then we've got the CSM land use and exposure profile. We're going to talk about current and reasonably anticipated future land use, talk about exposure scenarios and receptors. Again, I think it's helpful to categorize these. So in this example, you know, the categories are, you know, developed area where homes and roads and stores are. There's trails that are highlighted, then there's forest and maybe some agriculture. So with that, we've got a CSM, you know, we've got the basics for it, and, you know, and hopefully in the real world, you've got all the details as well. You get a consensus on that. Now with that, we can move into defining assessment areas. Now, again, I think it's important as you're going through your project, say, for example, you're doing an RI it might be helpful to go, at least for illustrative purposes, to go through all these steps to show where you're headed, and then understand that the RI is going to help you fill in the blanks. So the RI is going to tell you where that high use area is, where the low use area is. The RI is going to give you some more information on the land use activity. But it's certainly worthwhile to show what you intend to do with that information, and what that is follows. So define the assessment areas. In the RMM manual that's soon to be published, it's got a simple example here where there's two different land uses, you know, going left to right, two different MEC distributions, which is typical high use area, low use area. And then combining those gives us three assessment areas. Assessment area for the one land use area, and then the other land use area, we've divided into two to account for that that high use area, that amount of MEC. So applying that to our example, going back to our release profile, high use area, low use area, and then looking at our land use and exposure profile, and then just more or less overlapping those two layers, can give us some assessment areas. And they might look like this, for example. We might have developed area, trails, and forests for the high use area, developed area, trails, forests, and agriculture for the low use areas. So seven different assessment areas. I'm not saying you have to do it this way, but this is certainly one way it can be done. It's a logical way. You do whatever works for your project. But setting up those assessment areas is certainly useful and really helpful. So once you have that, now we're going to move in. We're going to dig a little deeper. We're going to look a little closer and look at receptor activities. Specifically, we're interested in those activities that may affect an outcome of an interaction with MEC. So, you know, anything that involves intrusive activities per se. Farming, for example, or maybe there's a playground there, or hiking is a common one. Construction, but we also want to consider if the area is, you know, already well developed, if there's a lot of existing structures and pavement. That's something that I've seen get overlooked in the development of the CSM. And then sometimes you've got things like for our underwater MRSs, you know, diving is something that comes up often. So we really need to start digging down and see, okay, what are people doing on this site? How are they using the site? What activities are going on? And then once we recognize the receptors and the activities, we're going to list at the task, you know, the hiker walked on the trail. And we're going to take it a step further and try to assess, you know, the frequency, the coverage, and then, of course, the depth. We want to know what the depth might go to. And that's going to be very important, and I'll show you why in just a second. So these interaction zones. So now we've got a CSM. We've defined these assessment areas. We've identified a handful of receptor activities. But now we need to look at the interaction zones. And that's when we're going to go vertical. That's when we use that vertical CSM that James talked about and the vertical profile. And we look at the different activities, receptor activity A, B, C, and D. And we use the information that we gather to assign a depth to those activities. Likewise, we use the information to assign anticipated maximum MEC depth. So again, getting back to the, you know, how the CSM can identify data gaps, here's another example. You know, at every munitions response site, we should be able to develop a chart like this to show these depths. We don't know what the activities are all the time, but we know we need to find out, so data gap. And we don't know what the depths are, but we need to find out. So it really becomes kind of a fill-in-the-blank type of exercise. But once we do have that, and, you know, we arrive at some sort of consensus on you know, where to draw those lines for the MEC depth and the MEC activities. Then we have these so-called interaction zones. So this is where it gets complicated. And that's okay, because as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, one of the points that I want to drive home is that we operate oftentimes in the margins. You know, if we're going into the high use area where we can detect and remove MEC, you know, that's pretty easy. We've got the equipment. We know how to do that. We're really good at it. With the no evidence of use area, no brainer, no evidence of use, don't need to do anything. So it's really kind of in the margins in these low use areas where I think historically we have not had the fidelity that we need to truly assess risk. There's been a lot of hand waving. And what we're trying to get to now is a point where we're looking at specific activities and depth. So yes, it does get a little complicated. It won't always be this complicated, but you know, I was talking to James about this, and you know, he told me, well, you know, complex sites are complex, and I think this is a decent example of that. So, going back to our review and consistency of the CSM, you know, that's our MRS and everything we know about it. Define the assessment areas. You know, that led us to have 7 different assessment areas. The receptor activities. We ended up, you know, some of the assessment activities had only activity A and B, some had A, B, C, some had A, B, C, and D, and so on. But that led us to have, I think this is 15 different interaction zones. So 15 different, what will be called risk scenarios. So we'll have to do a risk assessment, you know, for 15 different scenarios in this example. But that's okay. Don't let that scare you, because the risk assessment, if you're using the RMM, is pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy as long as you've done all the work up front with your CSM and going through, you know, these first 4 steps. Step 5 should be just kind of plug and chug. So to kind of sum it up and pull it together, you know, our conceptual site model, is this. I think this is one slide that I could use to take a new hire or a new trainee and sort of explain what a conceptual site model is and how we use it. You know, it's got the 5 profiles. We're even getting into the assessment areas and the depth profile. And I could explain that, you know, a lot of these things are unknown, but almost every CSM that you'll encounter will have these same fundamentals. So in summary, we need to recognize and use the CSM to inform our data needs for the investigation, if you're in the RI and the risk assessment, or for the remedial design. It doesn't change a whole lot in the remedial design. It's just there are fewer unknowns, hopefully a lot fewer. We need to continue to use and develop the CSM throughout the project. So James kind of answered this question. You know, it's the CSM is continuously updated, but on paper, it's more or less going to be updated at the beginning and the end of a phase. You know, using the RI as an example, when we're developing those QAP worksheets, we're going to have worksheet 10 that's going to give everything that we know about the CSM. Then at the end of it, we're going to have an RI report that's going to have a section that updates the CSM. But again, realizing that it gets updated, you know, throughout the process. Don't lose sight of the big picture. Hopefully I made that point. You know, sometimes we get a little too close to the canvas and we sort of lose sight of what it is that we're trying to do and where we're trying to go. Know the data you'll need and how it will be used. You know, that's essentially just the SPP and data quality objectives. There's plenty of training and information on that, but always good to keep that in mind. And then gather enough data for development of the remedial alternatives and cost estimate. Again, I didn't cover this. There's plenty of talks out there and presentations, but it's always important to point out that you've got to keep in mind also that you're going to be developing remedial alternatives in most cases, and those remedial alternatives have costs associated with them. So sometimes you need more data. You know, the data that's available to characterize a site might be great, but you might need a little bit more to really refine those remedial alternatives and develop good cost estimates. So that is it. I'm not sure, I wasn't paying too close attention to time, if I got time for questions or if we need to move on to Amanda. You tell me, James.
I think we only have a few questions to address, so I think we should probably just jump in and address them before we move on.
Let's do it.
So the first one is, and I'm willing to help you with this one if you want, but could you give an example of information used to define the anticipated maximum neck depth?
Well, sure, you can jump in, but one thing that I've commonly used in my experience is if we were doing a remedial investigation, we decided up front, you know, before we went out in the field and in those initial planning meetings, that we were going to consider the deepest munitions debris or mech that, you know, the deepest munitions related item that we found to be representative of the maximum anticipated mech depth.
Okay, I'm gonna have to step in and clarify that a bit then. I think we probably also need to realize that depending on how much investigation we've done during the RI, that may not be fully reflective. So we also need to modify that, I think, or potentially modify that using what we know about potential penetration depths of the mech that are being or the munitions that are being used at that site. And also, I mean, this is maybe less on the mech depth issue, but if you think you might have mech down to 2 feet, and you have land use down to 3 feet, it may, I mean, this is less a part of the CSM mech depth, but you may want to consider actually looking at depths down to 3 feet to make just absolute sure that you're protecting those users. But I think it is sometimes I see in reports or in our eyes that we detect that, you know, the deepest we detect a piece of MD is 6 inches and we've got 75 millimeter rounds at the site. It doesn't stand to reason that the deepest 75 millimeter round that we have at the site is only going to be 6 inches deep. So I think it may be a good initial indicator, but I think we have to use our best judgment as well to talk with the stakeholders and the other members of the PDT and work out what we think is a reasonable maximum neck depth. Sorry, Nick, for jumping all over your answer.
Oh, no problem. I think the takeaway is there's not a specific formula for it. There's many considerations that have to be made, and that should all be discussed with the project team and the stakeholders during the SPP.
So the next one is, during the receptor activities, non-human receptors were not discussed, which is a big component of evaluating the environment for protection of human health and the environment, which an eventual remedy needs to address, and which the CSM exposure pathway diagram also needs to address. So I guess the question there is, when we were talking about receptor activities for the net risk assessment, we didn't talk about non-human receptors.
That's not an omission. That's more or less something that's not considered when we're looking at mech. Certainly, if we're doing a risk assessment for munitions constituents, then we're looking at the ecological or the non-human. But it's rare, if ever, I've not encountered it, where we would be looking at the risk to animals from explosive incidents.
Yep, that's not typically done. I would to follow that, because one of the elements of the question also says an eventual remedy needs to address it. Obviously, if we have sensitive environments and TME species, then the remedy might address that, in terms of we would modify the remedy in order to make sure that we weren't disposing of explosives
in, say, a sensitive area, or you may even decide not to remediate an area where you have T&E species, because that may be a protected area where no one's going to be going, and you just don't want to go in there and chop all the brush down. So I think those things are addressed by the remedy, but would not necessarily be addressed by the risk assessment.
Yep, great clarification, thank you.
Let's see, the next one says, would the absence or presence of invasive species affect how you would address the low use area? I think we just answered that one. Same for archaeological or tribal finds. I think that last clarification probably addressed both of those questions. Do you concur, Nick?
Yes.
And then lastly, can the anticipated that be included consistently with the CSN provided with the PWS, i.e. worksheet 10, it would be helpful to have this info up front, and it's not reliant upon investigation data.
Yeah, well, if we're talking about an RI, then the anticipated MEC depth is one of those questions that we're trying to answer, right? If we're talking about a remedial action, then I believe that should be specified, certainly could be specified in the PWS.
Okay, and I think that's all the questions.
Okay,
great. Well, we're gonna go to Amanda.
Awesome, can you all see my slides?
We can.
Awesome. Nick, that was the perfect tie-in, talking about the RI, you know, that we're looking for the depths, and then going into the RA that, you know, we should have those well-defined, because we are going to look at the acquisition process and using the CSM as a mechanism for our systematic project planning, and the acquisition from the RI through the RA. We'll look at some best practices and data needs for characterization and contracting. We'll look at some constraints. We'll talk about details that matter. And early SPP involvement. We'll do a continuous check on the CSM. We'll circle back to the PWS and talk about planning and details. And then we'll do a reality check. But, you know, as James and Nick constantly touched on, the CSM is so integral to each piece of the project, you know, whether it's the performance work statement, the systematic planning process, you know, it ties into the field work. And each and every one of your deliverables, you know, we're constantly looking at that CSM, you know, whether we are trying to further refine it or get some more details from it, or just a continuous check. And let's begin by looking at the elephant in the room and how we adjust for that as a starting point in our acquisitions. You know, our most comprehensive technical approach, it maximizes our DGMs acre surveyed, as well as our intrusive investigations performed and our samples collected and time spent in the field, right? You know we need a robust investigation. But then if you look at the other side, your most competitive technical approach, you know, it minimizes our DGM acres surveyed, your intrusive investigations, your samples collected and your time spent in the field. So how do we get that to mesh? You know, instead of using the lowest price technically acceptable, USACE employs the best value trade-off analysis. The best trade-off value uses the technical approach as the most important factor. And this ties into FAR Part 15 with, and of course, the DoD source selection procedure and the Army source selection supplement. So again, this best value trade-off analysis ties in for the technical approach. Now, if we're looking at starting an acquisition, we realize there are a few constraints going in. You know, our expectations going into a project, we know off the bat we want our high quality product with sufficient data, right? We know we want an audible trail using AGC. We do realize that money is limited and, you know, your change orders and your requests for equitable adjustments, you know, they're undesirable. And then we look on the other side, in reality, the technical approach requirements could be subject to broad interpretation. You know, once we put it out to the contractors for solicitation, you know, there's a limited time to develop that complex technical approach to meet the deadlines. There could be some unknowns before field work, and the best technical approach could be subjective, and your cost proposals vary widely for field activities. So how do we get those things to mesh up a little bit more, looking at cost proposals and the technical approach, you know, where it could vary widely or it's open to broad interpretation? Well, the PWS details matter. If we start with a vague PWS and we say, hey, we want a car. Well, you know, that's open to interpretation, right? What kind of car is it? Is it a small car? Is it a luxury car? You know, and then with that, you're going to have a range of estimated cost as it relates to your PWS. So how do we help that? We look at, you know, making a more prescriptive PWS. Say, hey, we want an SUV with air conditioning and four-wheel drive. And so you've narrowed your scope a little bit. And because you've narrowed the scope, you have a range of estimated cost as it relates to your PW details. You know, it shrunk a little bit. So you've got a better margin with that. You know, again, don't ask for a car if the minimum you want is an SUV with air conditioning and four-wheel drive. You know, it helps on those details. So to put those details into the PWS, we start with the systematic planning process. You know, James brought up, it used to be called a technical process planning, TPP. And on the left-hand side, you'll see a screenshot of the EM200-115 that's getting ready to be re-released. It's being revised right now. But this planning session 1 and 2 that's highlighted right there, you know, that's before we release that out to the contractors. But this is where we need all of our stakeholders, our regulators. We need you all to come to the table, because to get those better details into the PWS, we want to have your involvement. So, you know, we start with the current available data. You know, James discussed that. You know, you're starting with all your documentation, you know, whether it's regardless of what phase you're in, you have some documentation on it. And then Nick alluded to, you want to look at the end goals of that phase, right? So start with the end in mind, but then plan for that along the way. In the bottom portion on the left-hand columns, you can see the outputs that we're going to get. So part of that is the draft PWS. So we want your input on that to help it more prescriptive. And then, of course, you're going to notate that in worksheet 9 of your QAP, please. You know, just making sure we write down the attendees, your topic of discussions, you know, and the decisions that you make and the rationale to get to there. And then we'll share that at the RFP. So how does the CSM components and these profiles to address tie into our acquisition? Well, you know, we have the facility profile talking about, you know, your man-made features, any kind of physical profiles that's really inaccessible. These all help us in our planning and writing, more so for worksheets 10 and 11, as well as, you know, putting in the PWS. Your release profile, your land use and exposure, great inputs for our acquisition, especially for this ecological and cultural resources. So I'll share a simple story with you. I was working on a project, Dolly Sod's maneuver area. And, you know, to begin with, we had really great involvement. And then there was some turnover with Fish and Wildlife, you know, and we're in the project for 2 years. We already have our QAP approved. And then we have some new personnel to the site and some new requirements that really weren't published just yet, but they wanted us to have a Cheat Mountain Salamander certified biologist. So they had to go through the training and all of that stuff. Even though the requirements weren't published yet, we needed to go through those. If you know any of those kind of critical elements before you start the acquisition that you can put into the PWS, it helps greatly. Looking at the vertical profile, there's so much you can gain from that on the acquisition side, you know, especially when you're looking at the RA phase. So your MEC and your seeding depths, you know, if you look at your pictorial on the right-hand side, you know, those account to your production rates, right? And then your instrument detection depths, you know, that gives us what instruments that we can use on the site, as well as your land use depths. This is so applicable to each phase. You know, it helps us planning for the future, as well as, you know, what you're currently in. And then, of course, our remedial action objective depths. You know, this feeds straight into our feasibility study as well as our RODs. And then we have a continuous check on the CSM, but it starts with our planning session one, you know, SPP meeting one. You know, it helps us define the overall objectives and identify your data gaps. And then, you know, planning session two, we have that site visit. We determine our data needs and our intended uses of data. We award the contract, and then we have the UFP QAP or the MR QAP development. And then we have the detailed comprehensive investigations and our weight of evidence. You know, I think Nick alluded to that a little bit, our weight of evidence. But make sure when you're going through that, even from planning session one and two, your SPP one and two, don't forget to talk about that weight of evidence when you're looking, you know, at your NEU areas. You know, HUA and LUA areas, you know, we typically do a really good job at defining that. But don't wait until after the fieldwork's performed that you're looking at the RI report and you say, this no evidence of use. We don't have enough information gathered on that to really say that that is NEU. So again, talk about that weight of evidence really early. In our fieldwork performed, you know, we're doing a constant check on the CSM, you know, as well as making sure we have our QA and QCs. And then with our reporting, we're looking at the risk assessment reports and our institutional analysis plan. Again, CSM is checked continuously throughout the whole thing. Something that will help when we're starting the acquisition is if we can structure the PWS with some flexibility. So include lots of options for your field work. You know, and look at including a phased approach for data gaps. You know, phase one on your removal action, you might want to say, hey, let's map the known areas and then 100% of the site with dynamic AGC. And then you would come in with phase two saying map the remaining data gaps and then dig and report. You can also include additional FUP, which is a fixed unit pricing task in addition to the base. But, you know, lessons learned, if we want something prescriptive, just make sure we ask for it in the PWS so it's not open to broad interpretation. And for the sake of time, I know we're running short on it, but I just want to say, you know, at the end of the project, make sure that they all match. When you're looking at your performance work statement, you know, and we're having these early conversations with the regulators, you know, make sure that it all makes sense. And then going to your proposals as well as, you know, what's actually done, you know, let's just do a sanity check and say, hey, does this make sense? Because at the end of it, you know, we're looking at the conceptual site model, the end in mind, but, you know, you're starting at the beginning. So this blue dotted line represents, you know, the estimated number of meg below ground surface, right? So you have this nice bell curve. And actually, you know, what happens when you find more? Does it make sense with what you all are thinking as well as, you know, what you've planned out on everything? But then what happens if our number shifts, you know, deeper down? Do you have things written in your PWS to account for that or your QAP? And then looking at your land use depths and then how that works into with your verified detection depths. It all, you know, it starts at the beginning with the end in mind, as Nick said. So wrapping it up, you know, planning for the PWS details, plan a site visit early ahead of your solicitation, course plan early and continuous for those rights of entry, very crucial. And, you know, with our regulators and stakeholders, you know, to include our tribes, we need buy-in at our initial meetings. You know, everybody's welcome at the table. It's a PDT decision. And then, you know, as I shared, on the Dolly Sods project, discuss those key personnel that will be needed for the project ahead of the award. Talk about that coverage, terrain, and sampling, and discuss the weight of evidence for no evidence of use areas, and then plan that site visit for the contractor. If you don't plan to execute, you could plan to fail, but ensure those requirements are transcribed in the PWS in the worksheet. Jason, I apologize. I know you're running short of time, but we are, we can take some questions, but I also want to put another plug in there. If you have topics that you would like presented in this forum, or if you're interested in presenting, please feel free to email me, and that's my email on the screen right now. All right, Nick, questions?
We did have a question. I think it came up before your talk, so I'm going to save it to the end and let Jason go ahead in the interest of time.
Perfect. Thanks.
So Jason, at this time, if you'd like to begin your screen share, we can confirm that your presentation materials are up and that your mic is on.
Yeah, can you hear me? Just a quick audio check.
You sound great.
Okay, 1 second, please. And can you see the presentation?
We can. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you so much. Well, good afternoon to everyone, and thank you for joining the call today. Thank you to Nick for inviting me to present. The topic I'm going to discuss today is, I think, one that I'm quickly becoming familiar with based on my experiences over the last year or so in project management. And that topic is the true cost of a bad CSM and the impact of a bad conceptual site model on reaching site closure. Up front, I'm going to say I'm by no means an expert on conceptual site models. However, as I stated, I'm quickly getting better at understanding the importance of a good CSM as we collectively move forward trying to achieve site closure at our properties. So over the course of my career as a geophysicist and project manager, I've experienced firsthand the painful experience of fallout from an incomplete CSM. There's probably no worse feeling than investing a lot of time and energy on a project only to have to take a step back and repeat a project phase due to issues that are identified with the CSM during the remedial action phase. I want to jump right into the conclusion before getting too deep into the presentation. So what is the cost of a true cost of a bad CSM? Well, I can tell you from my perspective that true cost of a bad CSM is pretty much dependent upon when the team realizes there's an issue with the conceptual site model and whether the project phase you're executing can adapt to those changes in the CSM. I guess I would argue, depending on the phase you're executing, the true cost can actually be undefined. To me, it would seem that if a thorough and complete CSM is developed by the time the team finishes the remedial investigation phase, the government and contractor teams can develop more reliable estimations of cleanup costs. However, an incomplete CSM at the conclusion of an RI can lead to underestimation of cleanup costs in the FS, which will impact the development of a solid decision document. And should an incomplete CSM be carried forward to the remedial action phase, most likely the team will not meet the requirements of the ROD, and potentially phases of the remediation process will have to be completed again. We could be looking at an explanation of significant differences to the ROD, potential modifications of the decision document, the possibility of scope expansion, and most likely there will be costly REAs to fill in data gaps. And in some of the worst case examples, a team may have to take multiple steps backwards in the CERCLA process to address the changes in the conceptual site model. Now, any one of these issues can disrupt program objectives for site closure, draw out the cleanup process, and possibly lead to completed phases being reopened, or the phrase that I like to use, which is the beans are coming out of the jar. So now that we've had that intro out of the way, let's quickly take a dive into what the CSM is in very simplified terms. First, the CSM is the most current description of the site and environment to include the description of the sources of contamination already discussed in previous talks. For our MMRP world, though, we're talking about MEC and MC. The CSM should address future land use, potential receptors, and exposure pathways for interaction with the contamination. Basically, the CSM is the tool decision makers utilize to support the path forward to meet project objectives, which often is UUE when possible, and ultimately site closure. Here we have a slide that depicts the CERCLA phase against the CSM detail and accuracy. The point being is as we step through the CERCLA process, the CSM should be more comprehensive and give a clearer depiction of the actual site conditions. I believe an argument could be made that this is not necessarily a linear relationship as depicted on the graph, but would be better suited for depiction by a curve with an inflection point occurring after the RI. So that in the initial phases of the PASARI, when we are really characterizing the site based on all the various inputs in order to truly understand the nature and extent of contamination, that slope is much steeper. So that by the time we reach the SF, that line should start to plateau out, meaning that all the work gone into those initial phases to develop a sound CSM is complete. If the CSM is solid, we can assume we've done our due diligence and the cost estimation we put together in the FS should be fairly accurate for the overall cleanup costs to get the team to whatever alternative is selected and implemented by the decision makers. Really, the CSM gives us a basic understanding of the site, such as types of MEC and MC, land use, receptors, and those potential exposure scenarios. Typically, the CSM has a narrative description that's supported by maps, figures, and graphics, very similar to what we see on the slide. The CSM forms the basis for communication with the stakeholders during the SPP and can be utilized to develop the investigation strategy as well as data quality objectives. Elements of the CSM are easily categorized into the various profiles outlined in the federal guidance, which we'll briefly touch on here. We have the facility profile, which addresses questions such as what is the history of the property and what were the land uses pre, during, and post DOD activities and or operations. The physical profile should address what are referred to as the geomorphological conditions, also including threatened and endangered species, as well as cultural resources. We have the release profile, where the CSM addresses locations of known or suspected contamination and the lateral and vertical extent of the various types of contamination. And we also have the land use and exposure profile that takes into consideration future and reasonably anticipated site use, current and future receptors, as well as exposure pathways. Of course, all the data from the various CSM profiles feed into the decision process on what we're trying to achieve as the end goal of a specific site. This slide depicts the vertical CSM, which is critically important for a good estimation of the cost to clean up a site, especially if we're trying to reach the coveted UUUE designation for a property. Understanding the vertical CSM can be dependent upon the profile history of a property. For example, was the site that we are characterizing formerly an impact area, a rifle range, or a target and maneuver area? The vertical CSM is oftentimes controlled by the physical profile of a site. Is the geologic setting of our site a thick alluvial depositional environment with aquifers near the surface, or do we have bedrock at the surface that would limit the penetration depth of potential MEC? Or is the bedrock at 2 feet below ground surface or 100 feet below ground surface? The point being is that if we can limit the depth of investigation based on something as simple as bedrock at the surface, a team can make objective decisions on potential cleanup depths to reach our project goals with more informed decisions. It's important to understand penetration depths, but it's equally important to understand whether or not that depth of penetration can be controlled by the near surface conditions. So now that we have the basics out of the way, I wanted to talk about how sometimes the CSM can get overlooked, pushed aside as a team is moving full steam ahead, executing a project. One of the biggest issues that I've noted recently is that during the RI, the CSM is not iteratively updated as new information comes in and teams are not revising those inputs and decision logic that are dictating the processes and procedures of the field investigation. Basically, I'm saying as though we develop this great work plan, assemble a quality team to complete the work, but then we get uber focused on just executing the plan so that when our preconceived notions about site conditions change, we don't change the plan to adapt to those new conditions. Really, I kind of view this issue as a carryover issue from contracts that were awarded 3 to 4 years ago, where we didn't have the requirement to have SPP meetings with all the decision makers prior to putting an RFP out on the street for work. Hopefully, as more project teams implement the newest guidance, the potential issues noted with poor CSMs will start to be resolved. So over the last year or so, I've seen plenty of examples where an incomplete CSM during the RI phase was propagated through to the feasibility study and decision document and ultimately impacted the cost to complete estimates as well as the actual implementation of that selected remedy. I would say, in my opinion, this is often due to poor communication between the field teams, the technical leads, and those decision makers regarding changes in the accepted CSM being addressed in a timely manner. With the basic understanding of the CSM, I want to now discuss a couple example projects where an incomplete CSM either impacted acceptance of the contractor work product or actually led a team having to take a couple steps backwards in CERCLA due to the significant data gaps. I know it's on the slide, but I'm going to say it anyways. The intent is not to single out any contractor or government team, but to get us all thinking about the overall implications of carrying a bad CSM forward and the negative impact it can have on meeting program objectives and potentially our working relationship as a government contractor team. So first up, we have what I'm referring to as the physical profile example. We touched on most of these attributes earlier, but I want to draw your attention to the questions highlighted for consideration. I bring these up because, as you will see, if these simple questions, if addressed during the project startup, could have or would have saved the team a few months of backtracking and scrambling to defend an analog work product. So when dealing with seed item placement, a critical question might be, how deep is the bedrock at the MRS? And will the depth of bedrock limit potential penetration depth for the investigation of MEC? More importantly, can we get our standard size ISOs buried to an adequate depth to test the reliability of detection for our selected instruments, which of course is critical to increasing the defensibility of our work products. In our first example, we have a contractor that moved out with an approved QOP for a remedial investigation in Montana. All field investigation work was completed with either an EM61 or an analog instrument. And in the physical profile of the CSM, the geologic setting of the site was characterized as, quote, largely made up of quaternary alluvium, mainly valley fill consisting of silt, sand, and gravel, including some terrace deposits and glacial drift of Pleistocene age in some areas. Locally, it would include hot spring tufa. So there's nothing really specific to our MRS and no maps showing the differentiation between the various deposits and outcrops across the MRS. Really, the geologic setting reads just like a description off of a unit map of a USGS map. So at the site, the DGM field crews went in surveys, went on as planned with the basic steps and parameters listed on the slide. I want to point out that at times, in an effort to increase the defensibility of our work products, we take what would seem like a good idea at the time, and by implementing it in the field, we actually create more issues for the project in the long run. I say this because, as you see on the slide, we're collecting DGM transects for an RI, but the contractor decided to place seed items on the DGM transects, even though there was no requirement to do so. The team was creative in making sure the seed item was traversed by the instrument operator, and really the seed items were just utilized to test the functionality of the instrument and not the operator. For our analog transects, it was a pretty textbook survey design. There was an ITS for daily checks, and there were predefined transects along lines of equal elevation. Operators worked in 5-foot sweep lines, and the decision logic to support the transect spacing was sound. And of course, we had the seed items to test the process. Here's a snapshot of how quiet our field area was with respect to the anomalies. VSP analysis was utilized to determine grid placement in areas where higher anomaly densities were noted. There were minimal anomalies at the site, and the assumed background density for the site was something like 5 anomalies per acre. So the good news for this project was that during field work, there were no MEC finds, and there were very limited munition debris recovered. As part of the pre-planning, the team decided that if any CMU areas or HUAs were encountered, that up to 4 100 by 100 foot grids would be in place, requiring 100% investigation. So due to the limited finds during phase one, the team focused the 4 grids in areas where the most MD was discovered during the analog investigations. Again, no MEC and limited MD were recovered from the grids, and the team was confident on a path forward for the site by the end of the field investigation, but then we ran into a little issue. Here on this slide, where we see that the grid layout with the grid anomaly densities. So during government QA review of the deliverables, it was noted by our lead OESS that the contractor did not meet the expected burial depth for QC seed items in analog areas to include the instrument test strip. The deliverable was rejected by the OSS, and the contractor was informed that they would need to recollect the affected data in order for the work product to be defensible based on approved QC procedures. Unfortunately, the seed items in the ITS and for the transects were not buried in accordance with approved QOP. The ground was too hard to bury the ISOs at the 95 to 100% detection depth in the proper orientations, and this issue was not documented in daily quality control reports, and there was never a nonconformance report or a corrective action report submitted to address the issue. Also, both the OESS and the UXO QCS missed the nonconformance while performing oversight of operations. The contractor's position was that the depth of bedrock was shallower than described in the CSM provided as government-furnished information. Therefore, seed items could not be buried to the proposed depth of detection. It's worthwhile to note that an infield adjustment would have been to utilize a smaller ISO, which could have been buried at a shallower depth, but this wasn't done. There was no field change request submitted to the government team during field work explaining the change in the approved field procedures based on the change in the CSM. The deliverable was rejected on the basis of improper burial depth of ISOs, which clearly should have been identified or documented by the on-site USACE OESS, as well as the contractor UXO QC manager. After weeks of discussion, the proposed path forward was for the contractor to update the CSM in the report based on the geologic setting and detailed analysis of soils of the site with field verification and documentation. There were definitely extra costs incurred by the contractor team by having to mobilize back to the site to document the near surface conditions at the ITS and on the transects, as well as to provide the graphic documenting the actual site conditions that limited the depth of seed item burial. However, this cost was probably a lot less than comparing it to having to redo the entire field effort. Really, in my opinion, the team went off course early on in the RI planning phase by not clearly describing the near surface conditions at the site, but more relying on the USGS quadrangle descriptions likely developed and memorialized in the PASI phases of the project. In the planning documents, the contractor outlined using small and medium ISOs, but when executing the field work, they were not able to bury these ISOs to the specified depths due to shallow bedrock over the majority of the MRS. If this issue would have been noticed and documented by the government and contractor oversight in the field, the team could have adapted and proposed using a different sized ISO. But what happened instead was the contractor field leads changed the metric on the fly in the field without concurrence from the larger PDT and the actual decision makers. In this particular example, a simple field change request or NCR or CAR could have been developed during the RI field work and probably would have sufficed for the change in ISO burial depths. But the team did not think it was important enough to warrant documentation and reporting. As previously stated, after the RI report was submitted and the seed item burial depth issue identified, the report was rejected and the contractor had to spend a few months sorting out a path forward. Luckily for everyone involved, this project had a happy ending, and we emerged from the RI with the defensible data and a good CSM and path forward to meet the program objectives. The second example I want to discuss is a bit more fascinating in my mind because of the overall cost implications and the current status of the project compared to where we were at project startup. This particular project was implementation of an approved rod with an RA in Pennsylvania. I use the word fascinating because, as you will see during the discussion of the project, all the information was right there in the project files, but due to a few slip-ups along the way, the obvious was overlooked. I would think that most would agree by the time we finish an RI, we had better have a solid CSM to assist in projecting good alternatives and cost estimation for site cleanup, as well as a path to protectiveness. For this example, I would like to pose the following questions about the release profile. Are we accounting for the potential, and is there something in the historical records that we should have considered when developing RI objectives and transect spacings? For this project, we initially awarded an RIFS-PPDD to a contractor. For their RI, the contractor executed an analog survey using VSP to determine an appropriate transect spacing to detect 3-inch Stokes mortars. The team executed the RI as planned and gained regulatory concurrence on the report and then moved forward to complete the FSPP and DD. Now, during the RI, the team did encounter mech and 52 munition debris items. And based on the RI results, the predicted mech MD density was about 0.1 per acre for 78 acres of the site. And the area was classified as a mech source area. This slide shows a graphic depiction of the RI transects and intrusive results with evidence of small arms ammunition, 3-inch Stokes mortars, and 37-millimeter projectiles. Based on these findings, one might ask what would be the appropriate potential mech item that should be accounted for in the RI transect spacing. This slide shows a summary of the RI results with evidence of the small arms ammunition, Stokes mortars, and 37-millimeter projectiles. And based on the RI results and data summary, the selected remedy for the MRS was surface and subsurface removal of mech to a depth of 16 inches. There was also about a 0.08 acre area of the site that was classified as a backstop berm for a small arms ammunition range where limited excavation for lead contamination would be required. The selected alternative was to provide the greatest effectiveness over the long term to reduce potential hazards for mech and MC and to achieve UUUE and thus reduce the need for land use controls and long-term monitoring. The government then awarded a separate contract to the same company that completed the RIFS PPDD for the remedial action. Now, during the remedial action, the contractor quickly ran into issues in the field due to a higher than expected anomaly density. As a result, only 29 of the 78 acres were completed prior to a stop work order being issued by the contracting officer. To further complicate the situation, the limited area designated for excavation for lead contaminated soils was actually littered with 37 millimeter MD as well as MPPEH. During the limited intrusive investigation completed at the site, the contractor recovered 20 mech MPPH items, 9,600 munition debris items, and about 20,000 non-munition related debris finds. The team not only discovered the predicted 3-inch Stokes mortar, but they also identified the 37-millimeter projectiles that were fused. This slide shows a snapshot of the MRS that was awarded for the RA, with the purple grids being the ones that the team completed prior to running out of budget and the stop work order being issued. This slide shows the distribution of MPPEH contamination. It's worth noting that we definitely have anomalies popping out at the outer edges of the MRS, which calls into question the adequacy of the RI investigation to determine the extent of the contamination. At this point, it's important to note that there was mention of the 37 millimeter in the SI report, as well as 37 millimeter munition debris that was discovered and confirmed during the RI. Ultimately, the RI underestimated the expected density and depth of MD and NMRD. As a result, the team did not clearly delineate the nature and extent of contamination. The VSP transects were based on detecting 3-inch Stokes mortars, not on 37 millimeter projectiles. The fact that during the RI, the transect spacing was initially based on detecting Stokes mortar, the contractor and government team should have known that the transect spacing was inadequate. In defense of the team, they did try to attempt to utilize a tighter transect spacing for what I'm assuming to be was a conservative approach to look for the potential of the unknown. Unfortunately, though, even reducing the transect spacing didn't allow the team to adequately characterize the site with respect to what was documented as potentially being at the site during the previous phases. Needless to say, the contractor, when executing the RA, started to come across higher than predicted anomaly densities for MD and NMRD, and they had to stop work on the project. In a summarizing statement from the site-specific final report, quote, a substantially higher anomaly density at the MRS than anticipated based on the current CSM, end quote. So MEC was also discovered at the MRS boundary, indicating that the RI did not adequately delineate the extent of contamination, keeping in mind that the same contractor that confirmed the CSM and the RI is now stating that the CSM was inadequate at capturing actual site conditions. The site-specific final report also concluded that the selected remedial action alternative identified in the ROD cannot be achieved based on the current site conditions and technology proposed or utilized. The SSFR concluded that the project should take a few steps back to the RI stage, and in addition to any transect work completed during a new RI, the team should utilize sampling grids to more adequately measure anomaly density of the MEC MPPH MD as well as the NMRD. Sometimes we think we know what the end state of a site should be, but reaching that end site is oftentimes, and in this case, impossible. The conclusion of the site-specific final report for Path Forward basically said the project site needs to go through further characterization to better understand the nature and extent of contamination, with a recommendation to complete an expanded RI, complete sample grids to better understand MEC density, and to get a better handle on the actual distribution of anomalies across the site, with the overall goal of getting a better handle on estimated cleanup costs. So here we have a project where the RI did not meet the objective of capturing nature and extent of contamination, which means we did not have a complete CSM moving forward from the RI to the FS, which overall impacted the FSPPDD and led to an overall underestimation of the actual cleanup cost for the site. The team did come across 37 millimeter projectiles in the field during the RI, but didn't think at the time to revise transect spacings to account for the potential of a 37 millimeter impact area. Now, had the transect spacings been revised to account for the 37 millimeter, the team would have had a more robust data set and a better depiction of anomaly densities as well as the extent of contamination. Essentially, by ignoring the potential 37 millimeter issue, the team utilized incorrect inputs into VSP, and I'll go out on a limb to say that the team did not complete a DUA or data usability analysis for the site of the RI data post-field surveys, and they also overlooked the issue with the transect spacing not being adequate enough to capture the 37 millimeter. In other words, we didn't update the CSM and revise the assumptions once new data was discovered. You know, it gets back to that whole iterative process we discussed earlier when reviewing the CSM that is critical to developing a solid CSM. On this particular project, we accomplished 25% of the RA before running out of budget, but I would argue we wasted significant time and effort investigating the non-munitions-related debris in one particular corner of the site when the team could have spent more time investigating and clearing areas of potential MEC contamination. I guarantee you the team spent a lot of time, effort, and budget investigating cultural debris if we only cleared 25% of our grids. Furthermore, all the funding expended to complete the RI, FS, PPDD will now have to be reallocated to redo the work. So now here we are. By not accounting for the 37 millimeter projectile that was documented in the SI, confirmed in the RI, the RA, we will no longer be able to meet ROD objectives of UUE. Realistically, I'm not sure any regulator would or should accept UUE where the entire site is cleared with an analog instrument. And guess what? That's exactly what the site-specific final report statement said at the end in the conclusions. So we have a couple other projects similar to the first example of a bad physical profile in the CSM leading to improperly buried seeds, but the contractors in these cases weren't able to explain away the issue. In one project, a remedial action in Montana, we recently had to reject an entire analog deliverable because the field team did not follow the approved QAP. The main issue, again, was very similar to the RI project in Montana, where both the core on-site OSS as well as the UXO QCS were not well-versed in the QAP requirements of detection depth for analog instrumentation. The same argument regarding shallower than anticipated bedrock came up, but unfortunately the teams were unable to prove that shallow bedrock was in the analog work areas, and it was just an unfortunate oversight by the UXO QC manager of the QAP requirements for seed item burial depths. For another RI project, this one in Idaho, we had the same issue with analog seeds not being buried deep enough, the same issues with OESS and UXO QCS manager not knowing the requirements. But in this contract, the contractor was able to convince the government team that the analog data gaps would be verified under a separate expanded RI where digital geophysical methods would be utilized to characterize the same area and thus validate the analog results. So some final thoughts. As described in the limited examples, a bad CSM can disrupt program objectives for said schedule of completion, and it can actually cause a team to take multiple steps backwards in the CERCLA process, at which point the true cost becomes undefined. The CSM, if not complete during the RI, can lead to an underestimation of the actual cleanup costs. A bad CSM can definitely impact the decisions captured in the ROD and can lead to untimely project delays, ESDs, potential modifications to the approved ROD. Now, when this occurs, we have to be prepared probably for costly REAs, potential scope expansion, or in worst case scenario, contract termination for convenience. But worst of all, beans will come out of that phase complete jar, and a project team may have to redo a project, which require another investment to redo the work already paid for and completed, and could thus drag out the RA process for many more years, which will and could impact work scheduled for other high priority projects. And with that, what I would like to say is that concludes the presentation. And I just wanted to say real quick, thank you for your time this afternoon. Thank you to Nick and everyone in attendance for asking me to participate and present. And if you guys have any questions, I'm available to answer them. Over.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jason. I do appreciate that. Unfortunately, we are significantly over our scheduled end time for today. There were several questions that were entered into the Q&A, and our other co-speakers were in the background sort of typing replies to those questions. So I'll encourage the audience to browse through the Q&A tab to see the written responses to some of those questions that came in earlier. I do want to respect everybody's time, and I'll just go through a few quick closing reminders before we conclude today's live broadcast. So first, we wanted to let everyone know that this is the first of several webinars that are scheduled throughout the remainder of this year as part of the M2 S2 fiscal year 22 series. We hope that you can join us on May 25th when the life of a SCM continues with the conceptual site model project studies. We'll have registration open on the CLUIN website for that. So we encourage you to visit our calendar and register for that. And then the next topic will be on July 20th when we're looking at risk assessment and RAOs for munitions response. And then we'll ask everybody to save the date for their October 19th webinar where our topic will be announced shortly. We encourage you to visit us, as I said, on the CLUIN website to find those future M2 S2 webinars and sign up. You can find us at cluin.org. And you may also want to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, so that you can get the information about our upcoming webinars sent right to you in your inbox. Our next Tech Direct will go out on April 1st. So I do encourage you to sign up for that free newsletter service. As was highlighted at the start of today's webinar, there is a seminar homepage. It's shown in red on this slide. That homepage will be available from today forward, and it has a series of buttons or tabs right along the middle of it. And one of the tabs is a webinar slides tab. If you click that, you can actually download copies of the presentation material. So for those of you who are looking for copies of the slides, we already have those posted. If you're watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can go to that URL and still download the presentation materials. And there are related documents and websites that have also been posted on that related links tab, as well as information about our speakers. And then last but not least, very important is our seminar feedback form. So for those of you who are looking to get credit or participation certificates, I'll encourage you to visit that feedback form tab and fill that out, because I oftentimes get asked for those types of certificates, and we can generate them for you, but you need to fill out the feedback form. So be careful when you fill out that feedback form. Please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form certifying you were here for the entire delivery, and then hit submit. When you hit submit on that feedback form, you should then have access to a screen which will let you download a certificate. We'll also email you a copy, but I do encourage you to download the one from the confirmation screen you'll see, because sometimes the email versions can get caught in your spam or junk folders. If you don't receive that certificate, feel free to send me an email. We'll go into the system and see if we can regenerate it for you. If you happen to share the line with multiple people, you can simply share the link to the feedback form with those individuals, and each person can fill out the form on their own, even if they didn't register independently, and they can still get their own participation certificate. And then for those of you who are lucky enough to be replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still fill out that form, still access all of the materials, and get a certificate based off of your replay of the archive session. So if you look in the far upper right in our online archive, you should see a button that will point you to that seminar feedback form. Or again, you can manually type in the URL shown in red and click on the tab to the feedback form to fill it out. So with that, I want to thank all of the presenters and the organizers, and I want to thank the nearly 150 attendees who joined us for today's live session. We'll go ahead and formally conclude our broadcast. We hope that you found this to be of value.